Hello, and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks, The Learning College. Today we're going to resume the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man by Nation of Islam. It's part of their series called The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume Number 3. Again, The Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. And we're going to conclude the section on prosecution or persecution. We've already gone through the trial. Leo Frank is found guilty and sentenced to death. He has 13 appeals, and they all uphold the conviction and the sentence. And the Jews will go on after that to make a case based on lies that anti-Semitism was the reason for his conviction, that he was innocent, and anti-Semitic hostility in Georgia is the reason he was fingered and convicted. It's a complete lie. Jews know it to be a lie, but they have nevertheless continued to lie and elaborate and build on their lie for over 100 years. So we're going to do pages 180 to 210. Picking up, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. It's my forum, and also at alexlinder.com eventually. We have a lot of other audiobooks there. Now, on 180, we're mid-section on prosecution or persecution. There's examples of how blacks were portrayed. Again, Atlanta had three dailies, and they really showed blacks as, if you've ever seen those little, they're called Africana figurines made of bisque and such, the equivalent in press is what they would run in the paper back then, quite openly. Today we call it horribly racist caricatures of blacks with super thick lips, essentially that Al Jolson look, but in comics. And it says, the Jewish managing editor at 180 and 181 have pages of this stuff. The Jewish managing editor of the Atlanta Journal, John Cohen, was most supportive of Leo Frank. This is a sample of the paper's racial content during the Frank case. Scholars have claimed that, quote, anti-Semitism was rampant, but none have mentioned this kind of overt Jewish racism. So they were happy to play to white beliefs about blacks in the most extreme racist caricatures in order to try to get their pedophile rapist murderer off the hook. And again, we saw there were three Atlanta dailies, and Jews, I don't know that they owned them, at least one of them was owned by a Goy Hearst, but they were all had favorable coverage to Frank. So there was no anti-Semitism in the press, and the point made last time was that all the Jewish, as is typical, the Jews owned the retail companies that would make up most of the advertising. They all ran their ads all through these papers during their period. They had Jewish managing editors and senior editors, and the top editorial guys were Jews back then, just like now. So they had pro-Frank coverage, not anti-Frank coverage, as Jews would lie later on. So they really are a race of liars. Ad for the Birth of a Nation, all kind of picture of a coon shooting pool, coons going after each other, a coon dusting off the coat of a fat white man, a coon mammy, coon with money and liquor, and I loves my fish, a coon with a big fish under his arm, and just Al Jolson-like caricatures is the best way to put it, in print, in papers edited by Jews, in papers that were pro-Frank. So don't believe Jewish lies. The truth is the opposite of what Jews claim. 182, Leo Frank's Willing Mythmakers. Epigraph. Observe the operations of the white man. He is successful. He makes no excuses for his failures. He works hard in a collective manner. You do the same. The Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, that's the guy who founded the Nation of Islam. Leo Frank's Willing Mythmakers, again, that's the section we're getting into now, within prosecution or persecution. After almost a century of energetic circulation, the, quote, hang the Jew or we'll hang you claim is proved to be mere propaganda for the promotion of the Leo Frank legend. The sheer number of respectable authors that have trafficked in some version of the falsehood is truly breathtaking. Major publishers like Henry Holt, HarperCollins, and Oxford University Press, and academic centers like the American Jewish Historical Society The Jewish Virtual Library and the American Jewish Archives have allowed the false claim to find its way into the most scholarly journals, some being standards in their field. Here are just some of the many published variations on the, quote, hang the Jew fable. That is, it's wholly concocted. No one said that. It was made up by Jews or Jew-paid goyim in the media to circulate, which was once falsely... Here are just some of the many published variations, and they're going to have a chart here that we'll read through. Here are just some of the many published variations on the, quote, hang the Jew fable, which was once falsely promoted by these authors and publishers as the only truth of the Leo Frank case. Chart. Source and myth. Source. Abraham Foxman, former national director of the Anti-Defamation League. Quote, his trial was a spectacle, threats, intimidation, and a boisterous crowd outside chanting, kill the Jew and hang the Jew could easily be heard through the courtroom's open windows. So Abraham Foxman is a liar. Anti-Defamation League website. Hang the Jew, direct quote. This was the cry of the furious mob outside the Atlanta courthouse. So the ADL is a liar. Next source, Will Haygood. Showdown, Thurgood Marshall and the Supreme Court nomination that changed America. Quote, Frank had his day in court. Hang the Jew or we'll hang you were some of the shouts he heard while seated. So Will Haygood is a liar. S.L. Alexander, Media in American Courts. Quote, during the trial, crowds outside the courthouse had chanted, hang the Jew or we'll hang you. S.L. Alexander is a liar. Harry Golden, various books and articles. Quote, the crowd shouted to the jury, hang the Jew or we'll hang you. Crowd shouted, hang the Jew, as the mob shouted, hang the Jew or we'll hang you. Quote, even after the crowd shouted, hang the Jew, and a tent evangelist thundered at the open window to the spectators in the courtroom, the Jew is the synagogue of Satan. So Harry Golden is a liar, a multiple liar, a serial liar. C. Van Woodward, Tom Watson, I guess a book. Quote, hang the Jew or we will hang you. ADL, hate groups in America, a record of bigotry and violence. Quote, mobs outside the courthouse calling for his death. Remember, the Jews have apparently now dropped the claim that this was said, but for decades they insisted that it was. So they, Jews shuffle and create and raise or lower lies depending on what they calculate to be to their best advantage at any given time. Raphael Medoff, Jewish Americans and Political Participation, a reference handbook. Quote, incited by the rabble-rousing Georgia politician and publisher Tom Watson, anti-Semitic mobs filled the courtroom and surrounded the courthouse during the trial, making a guilty verdict almost inevitable. So, Raphael Medoff, M-E-D-O-F-F, is a liar. Dale Schwartz, an ADL attorney. Quote, the jurors were intimidated during the trial by crowds outside the courthouse, which would chant, hang the Jew or we'll hang you, as they entered. There were lots of windows being broken. Rich's department store had a standing order to replace their plate glass windows every morning during this period. End quote. So Dale Schwartz, ADL attorney, is a liar. Fry and Thompson, the silent and the damned. The mob was breathing vengeance in the very face of the judge and jury. Fry and Thompson are liars. American Jewish Historical Society. Quote, crowds outside the courthouse shouted, hang the Jew. One juror had been overheard to say before his selection for the jury, I am glad they indicted the goddamn Jew. They ought to take him out and lynch him. And if I get on that jury, I'll hang that Jew for sure. The American Jewish Historical Society publishes lies. Notice all the leading Jews and all the leading Jewish organizations repeat lies they know to be lies. They're not mistaken. They're lying. Jews are a race of liars. Take that to heart. It's not an exaggeration. It's a truth. New Orleans Rabbi Max Heller, quote, the courtroom was surrounded by vociferous mob whose violent demonstrations against the accused could not have but reached the ears of the judge and jury. So New Orleans Rabbi Max Heller is a liar. Jules Archer, Riot, A History of Mob Action in the United States. Quote, one notorious riot involved Leo Frank. Notes were sent to court officials, hang the Jew or we will hang you. So Jules Archer is a liar. Nathan Ausubel, A-U-S-U-B-E-L, The Book of Jewish Knowledge. Outside the courthouse in the prison where he was confined, the mob chanted, "Hang the Jew!" Again, direct quote, and again, Nathan Ausubel is a liar. Arthur G. Powell, I Can Go Home Again. Quote, with the mob in the streets around the courthouse grumbling for vengeance and howling for his blood, Arthur G. Powell is a liar. And by God, there's more pages of this. And we'll keep right on going through it. American Israelite, remember, the number one Jewish paper in the country at that time, threw out several issues. Quote, the courthouse was surrounded by a howling mob. The windows of the courtroom and the jury room were open, and the cries of the mob, to hang the Jew, could be plainly heard. The air about the courtroom was surcharged with mob violence. Fanaticism, fostered by the Protestant Ministers Association, which has manifested itself in a blind fury that would do credit to a mad mullah. It is no marvel that justice may have miscarried and that a jury composed of ordinary mortals may have feared for their very lives with a mob howling and threatening below the open windows of the courtroom. So that just out and out lying, and there's more. Outside the courtroom, a howling mob had gathered, and under the window of the jury room, they shouted epithets of hostility to anyone who would stand up for Frank. "Get the Jew" was the most frequently heard expression. The public clamored for his conviction and death. The trial court was terrorized. The moment the cry of "Hang the Jew" was raised, the case was made one of interest to every Jew in the United States. So the number one Jewish newspaper in the U.S., is publishing deliberate lies repeatedly through its issues. Jews are a race of liars. Liva, L-I-V-A, Baker, the justice from Beacon Hill, the life and times of Oliver Wendell Holmes. Quote, but what really convicted Leo Frank was the crowd. Its chanting of "Hang the Jew or we'll hang you" could be heard in the courtroom through the open windows by lawyers, judge, jury, witnesses, and the defendant himself. Leva Baker is a liar. Harry Bernard, The Forging of an American Jew, The Life and Times of Judge Julian W. Mack. Quote, "Hang the Jew or we'll hang you," they screamed at the jurors. Harry Bernard is a liar. Mark K. Bauman, Dixie Diaspora, An Anthology of Southern Jewish History. Quote, the crowd outside the courtroom chanted, "Hang the Jew, hang the Jew." So Mark K. Bauman, B-A-U-M-A-N, is a liar. Mark Bauman in the Georgia Historical Quarterly. Don't know if it's the same. In a sensational trial in an anti-Semitic atmosphere, Frank was found guilty of murder and sentenced to death. Mark Bauman is a liar. Larry Tye, T-Y-E, Homelands, Portraits of the New Jewish Diaspora. Quote, every day for a month, jurors entered and exiting the courthouse, entering and exiting the courthouse, had to wade through crowds screaming, "The Jew is the synagogue of Satan," and "Crack that Jew's neck," while defense lawyers and the judges were warned they would not leave the courtroom alive if the damn Jew was acquitted. Larry Tye is a liar. Nathan C. Belth, B-E-L-T-H, A Promise to Keep. Quote, over and over, louder and louder, the men repeated the chant, "Hang the Jew, hang the Jew." Nathan C. Belth is a liar. David Harry Bennett, The Party of Fear. Quote, the jury received messages threatening, "Hang the Jew or we will hang you." David Harry Bennett is a liar. Kristen Boudreau, The Spectacle of Death, Populist Literary Responses to American Capital Cases. Quote, unless you hang the Jew, we will get you. Direct quote. Kristen Boudreau is a liar. Tim Cousins, or Cousins, C-O-U-Z-E-N-S, Tramp Royal. Quote, they shouted at Frank's lawyers, hang the Jew or we'll hang you. Tim Cousins is a liar. Leonard Dinnerstein, Uneasy at Home. Quote, Frank's lawyers had received anonymous phone calls with a cryptic message, if they don't hang the Jew, we'll hang you. Crowds outside of the courtroom frequently hurled epithets like, lynch him and crack that Jew's neck. The jury was also threatened with lynching if it did not hang that damned sheeny. Leonard Dinnerstein is a liar. Lawrence Jeffrey Epstein at the edge of a dream. Quote, the New York Herald Tribune said, mobs choked the area around the courthouse. Men with rifles stood at the open windows. Some aimed at the jury, some aimed at the judge. These men repeated the chant, hang the Jew, hang the Jew. Lawrence Jeffrey Epstein is a liar. Everybody's Magazine, March 1915. Officials were the recipients of threatening letters and messages, hang the Jew or we'll hang you. Stanley Feldstein, the land that I show you. Quote, crack the Jew's neck, they shouted, lynch him. Direct quotes. Inside, spectators followed suits. Some officials, declared another spectator, received threatening phone calls and notes demanding that they hang the Jew or we'll hang you. One member of the jury reported that he wasn't sure of anything except that unless we convicted Frank, we would never get home alive. The courtroom and streets were filled with an angry, determined crowd, ready to seize the defendant. On the streets, unseemly demonstrations in condemnation of Frank were heard by the judge and jury. The judge was powerless to prevent these outbursts in the courtroom, and the police were unable to control the crowd outside. The mob, said one eyewitness, was breathing vengeance in the very face of the judge and jury. Stanley Feldstein is a multiple repeated liar. Norman H. Finkelstein, chants of hang the Jew and the inflammatory words of traveling preachers, the Jew is the synagogue of Satan, nearly drowned out the legal proceedings inside. Hawkers on the street sold a variety of anti-Semitic pamphlets. Norman H. Finkelstein is a liar, and that was in Forged in Freedom. Louis Fisher, American Constitutional Law. His trial was dominated by angry crowds chanting hang the Jew. Louis Fisher is a liar. And you notice we're only up to the F's. And across all media, academic, newspapers, magazine articles, lies that Jews create, they recirculate, and they spread out like waves until the truth is completely covered up. That's the ability that control of the mass media affords you, and that's why Jews always make a beeline to control any new medium, because it gives them an incredible leverage and power that they don't have by numbers, where they're only a small percentage, but it lets them control huge numbers of people with this fake history, these fake ideas, this lying about everything that touches them. Anywhere they can gain an advantage, they lie. Leo Frank, quoted in the Frank case, American Israelite, quote, an atmosphere seething with mob violence and clamor for my life. Leo Frank is a liar, as well as a pedophile, rapist, and murderer. Ronald Gottesman and Richard Maxwell Brown, editors, Violence in America, quote, shouting threats to the jury through the open windows, hang the Jew. Again, never said. Ronald Gottesman and Richard Maxwell Brown are liars. Melissa Faye Green, the temple bombing. Quote, every day for a month, the jurors traveled to and from the courthouse through the mob streets where people cried out, crack that Jew's neck and hang the damn Sheeny. And the judge and the defense attorneys were threatened. Melissa Faye Green is a liar. Flipping over onto page 186, we got another good number, two more pages to go. These are all the sources. Everywhere you look, Jewish organs, mass media organs controlled by Jews, magazines, newspapers are all saying the same thing, and they're all lies. David C. Gross, the Jewish People's Almanac, quote, over and over, louder and louder, the men repeated the same chant, hang the Jew, hang the Jew, hang the Jew. Did not happen. David C. Gross is a liar. Jeffrey S. Gurock, G-U-R-O-C-K, and Jacaranda Wiley, Anti-Semitism in America, quote, crack the Jew's neck. Jeffrey Gurock and Jacaranda Wiley are liars. Ben Haas, KKK, threatening mobs gathered around the courthouse during the trial crying, hang the Jew. Ben Haas is a liar, H-A-A-S. Stuart Allen Rockoff, Jewish Racial Identity in Pittsburgh and Atlanta, 1890 to 1930, a PhD dissertation. Quote, in late July of 1913, Frank's trial began. Large crowds of people gathered outside the courthouse to root on the prosecution and threaten the jury as they entered and exited the building, yelling such things as, quote, kill the Jew. Sam Stuart Allen Rockoff is a liar. Kermit Hall and David Scott Clark, The Oxford Companion to American Law, quote, ... Shouts of hang the Jew were periodically heard in the courtroom. Kermit Hall and David Scott Clark are liars. See, even the Oxford Companion to American Law, though, where they're trying to be right, they're lying. Jewish Currents, I guess a magazine, quote, in the sweltering heat, their tribal chant, like a tidal surge, hang the Jew. Jewish Currents publishes lies. Robert Michael, A Concise History of American Anti-Semitism, quote, the jurors had to pass through a barrage of anti-Semitic curses from the crowds, numbering in the thousands, at the courthouse. A favorite epithet was taken straight from the New Testament book of Revelation, 2:9 and 3:9. The Jew is the synagogue of Satan. Robert Michael is a liar. Jewish Virtual Library, which you can find online, I believe, quote, crowds outside the courthouse shouted, hang the Jew. Jewish Virtual Library publishes lies. Michael J. Klarman, From Jim Crow to Civil Rights, writes, quote, each day, trial participants could hear a mob screaming, hang the Jew, through the open windows. Michael J. Klarman is a liar. William Kunstler, there's a big name, and Justice for All, quote, the courthouse was ringed by thousands of people who shouted such pleasantries as, hang the Jew or we will hang you. William Kunstler is a liar. Howard J. Langer, The History of the Holocaust, quote, jurors heard mobs shouting, hang the Jew, through courthouse windows. Howard J. Langer is a liar. Elisa Lebow, L-E-B-O-W, First Person Jewish, quote, a rowdy crowd outside the trial allegedly shouted, hang the Jew. Well, I won't call her a liar. She put in allegedly. Now, it happens to be false. She's probably a liar, given that all the rest of these Jews are. But it's interesting that she alone, so far, in this chart, included the word allegedly, which admits she can't prove it. And, in fact, it did not take place. Leonard W. Levy et al., that means in the others, Encyclopedia of the American Constitution, quote, a mob shouting outside the courtroom, hang the Jew or we'll hang you. Leonard W. Levy, L-E-V-Y, et al. Are liars. Alonzo Mann, not a Jew, in 1982, 69 years after he had testified at the trial as a 13-year-old boy, quote, there were crowds in the street who were angry and who were saying that Leo Frank should die. Some were yelling things like, kill the Jew. Alonzo Mann is a liar. Jacob Rader Marcus, Critical Studies in American Jewish History, quote, crack the Jew's neck. Jacob Rader Marcus is a liar. Alan Middleman, Robert A. Licht, and Jonathan D. Sarna, Jewish Polity and American Civil Society, quote, only a few months before the ADL's founding, 1913, a young Jew named Leo Frank had been convicted of rape and murder after a trial by prejudice in which mobs choked the courthouse area screaming, hang the Jew. Alan Middleman, Robert A. Licht, and Jonathan Sarnow are liars. Gustavus Myers, M-Y-E-R-S, and Henry M. Christman, Christman, History of Bigotry in the United States, quote, hang the Jew or we will hang you, was the purport of notifications to court officials, and these menaces were reinforced by threatening mobs choking the area around the courthouse and adjacent approaches. Gustavus Myers and Henry M. Christman are liars. Lewis J. Paper, Brandeis, An Intimate Biography, quote, the courts, quote, the crowds outside the courthouse kept chanting, hang the Jew. Lewis J. Paper is a liar. Shelley Kapnek Rosenberg, K-A-P-N-E-K, et al., History of the Jews in America. Quote, although the case against him was weak, lie, crowds stood outside the courthouse screaming, hang the Jew. Two lines, two lies. Shelley Kapnek Rosenberg, et al., is a liar. Are liars. Jonathan D. Sarna, The American Jewish Experience, Sarna, American Judaism, A History, quote, crowds outside the courthouse chanted, hang the Jew. Jonathan D. Sarna, S-A-R-N-A, is a liar. Harry Simonoff, Saga of American Jewry. The court officials, quote, receive messages, hang the Jew or we will hang you. Harry Simonoff is a liar, S-I-M-O-N-H-O-F-F. Howard Simmons, Jewish Times, quote, ellipsis, as the jury came in every day, the crowd outside was reported by the press to chant, hang the Jew or we'll hang you. There were lots of windows being broken. Howard Simons is a liar. Southern Exposure, a magazine, Institute for Southern Studies, quote, crowds gathered outside the courthouse chanting, hang the Jew. Southern Exposure publishes lies. Samuel Tenenbaum, T-E-N-E-N, Why Men Hate, quote, they heard mobs shouting, hang the Jew or we will hang you. Samuel Tenenbaum is a liar. Elaine Marie Alphin, A-L-P-H-I-N, An Unspeakable Crime, quote, the crowd outside, dot, 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 the crowd outside, people cheered, booed, and shouted at the witnesses, the lawyers, the judge, and even the jury. They threatened, hang that Jew or we'll hang you. Elaine Marie Alphin is a liar. Michael Bronski, The Return of the Repressed in Shofar. That's that horn they blow. Quote, ellipsis, during the trial, the growing mob outside of the courthouse would give voice to such sentiments as wanting the damn Jew, quote, to be convicted. The popular sentiment on the streets specifically equated Frank's Jewishness with his guilt. Michael Bronski is a liar. Quote, his life to vent public prejudice in the Washington Post. Quote, shall Leo M. Frank go to his death a victim of an ancient and merciless prejudice, reflecting men recall with sober shame the ribald jeers and ravening bloodlust with which disorderly mobs surrounded the scene of his trial and communicated their evil prejudices to the minds of those who decided his fate. The Washington Post publishes lies. I'm guessing of all these quotes, you were aware of that already. And finally, Peter Golden, O Powerful Western Star, American Jews, Russian Jews, and the Final Battle. Quote, during the trial, which made national headlines, angry mobs besieged the courthouse. That is a lie, and Peter Golden is a liar. And we're done with that chart. That was a bit much, but it was a bit necessary. So it proves that there's comprehensive lying. But that's not exhaustive. There's plenty more references you could find. They're all repeating lies concocted or subsidized, paid for, by Jews about the conditions under which Leo Frank's trial was conducted. In fact, the trial was peaceful. There were no threats. There were no men with guns standing around looking in. There's no one screaming, kill the Jew. There's no one screaming, crack his neck. All these are Jew-concocted lies. Jews lie to protect their own pedophile rapist murderer who was duly convicted. He had the best defense money could buy, the biggest case ever. The defense and the prosecution bent over backwards to say they were not prejudiced against Jews. He was guilty. He was convicted. He was sentenced to death. And there's an end to it. Anything else, any other claims are lies from liars. Lying to protect pedophile, rapist, murderers. What kind of a people do that? Protect that kind? Jews. Next subsection, as we turn on to page 188. Jews in the Philo-Semitic Apartheid South. Two epigraphs. At the time of the Fagan murder, Atlanta was a Philo-Semitic city. Its assimilated German-Jewish elite were part of the financial and legal power structure. Steve Oney, one of the biggest names along with Dinerstein, admits that, says that Atlanta was Philo-Semitic, even though his people would go on to lie that Atlanta was anti-Semitic later for 100 years. And the next from Leo Frank, the city of Atlanta has grown to its present greatness and must depend for its future growth upon young men like myself. Leo Frank. Now turning to the text, an important myth about the position of Jews in the South during the slavery and Jim Crow eras continues to heavily influence common perceptions about the Leo Frank case. Fundamental to the popular legend of Leo Frank is the belief that Jews in the South were somehow outsiders in a peculiarly evil culture, and thus more prone to be victimized by the swirl of regional race hatreds. Nearly every published handling of the case is framed by this presumption that the well-known anti-black racism of the South also extended to Jews. Therefore, the fate of Leo Frank must be understood in that violent and xenophobic context. But the history of the American South shows that the atmosphere for Jews during the eras of slavery and Jim Crow, before and after the Civil War, that is, up to the Leo Frank case, was not just attractive, but especially welcoming, and, most of all, extremely profitable. So I actually saw someone disputing this on Gab. It amazed me. The fellow is sensible in other ways. Read the first two volumes of the Nation of Islam series on the secret relationship between blacks and Jews. We're now in the third volume. The first two cover the Jewish utter domination proved from Jewish sources of the Atlantic slave trade in black Africans. Jews dominated it. And they also, in volume two, they dominated the slave production, what the slaves were used to produce in the Americas. They were the middlemen and the dealers and the plantation owners, many of them. They dominated that as well. So they're trying to portray, oh, the South is really anti-Semitic. People hated Jews down there. No, they were integrated into the white Southern elite and were treated as white men, and even with an extra advantage of they're seen as these noble elder brothers in Christ. They didn't use that phrase back then, but that was kind of the spirit of it. Because the South was WASP Protestant, and that Protestants have always essentially said, modeled themselves on the Jews of the Old Testament. And seeing Jews as the sort of a descendants of the originals that they're modeling themselves on, they had respect for them. And this is alluded to in the, or mentioned in the closing speech given by the prosecutor Hugh Dorsey. So the South, as it correctly says in the title of this subsection, was philo-Semitic, pro-Jew. They liked Jews. They were Jew-positive down there. The indigenous Creek Nation Indians, decimated by the genocidal European invasion, were forcibly expelled to make way for the African slave-based plantation system. Jews arrived in colonial Georgia in 1733, 180 years before the murder of Mary Fagan, and they were well integrated in the settlement among their Gentile neighbors. One of the most popular writers on 20th century Southern Jewry, Harry Golden, himself a scholar of the Leo Frank case, addressed a persistent theme about Southern Jewish history he was determined to debunk. Quote, "The point I hope to establish is that this, quote, most Gentile, unquote, section of America has provided the most favorable, quote, atmosphere, unquote, the Jewish people have ever known in the modern world." Golden was speaking specifically about the American South. The reverence that most Bible Belt evangelical Christians held for the people of the book, quote unquote, placed Jewish immigrants in a special class. Their presence was even taken by many Southern Gentiles as a sign of God's favor and his endorsement of their slave-based society. In fact, Christians in the American South were time and again militantly protective of their Jewish population. A century and a half before New York became the focal point of Jewish life, wealthy and cultured Jews thrived in the large elite community of Charleston, South Carolina. That was the center of the slave trade in the South, where all the rich people were. They'd hire overseers to run their plantations, and a lot of them were just party nonstop in Charleston. And then their culture in South Carolina came from the essentially the Barbados. That plantation society was going to reproduce itself in South Carolina. The city was both a major slave trading center and the birthplace of Reform Judaism, the branch of religion to which Leo Frank belonged, that is, a more liberal Jews, and with which most Jews identify today as opposed to Orthodox or conservative. Reform Jews, the majority, and they're more leftist. Since the earliest times, and remember, Georgia was founded as sort of a Catholic colony or Catholic asylum amongst the other mainly WASP Protestant colonies. Since the earliest times, Georgia's Jews had enthusiastically performed their sacred Southern duties as slave masters and slave dealers, and all had shared in the benefits of the African slave trade. And let's read a footnote here, 421. On page 226 of his book on the Frank case, A Little Girl is Dead, Harry Golden says, "Nowhere in America were Jews made more welcome than in Georgia. Indeed, the entire South had always been philo-Semitic. The Protestant fundamentalism of the South greeted the Jew with unusual generosity. As the Jew went about his business, peddling from home to home or selling merchandise, his Gentile neighbors saw in him a living witness of all the biblical truths about Moses, Isaiah, Jeremiah, and the second coming of Jesus." In 1901, the Jewish Encyclopedia made an astounding claim that put Jewish Americans at the epicenter of the slaveocracy. The Jewish Encyclopedia in 1901 says, quote, "The cotton plantations in many parts of the South were wholly in the hands of Jews, and as a consequence of slavery found its advocates among them." How about that? So they completely dominated the cotton dealing. The slaveholding Charleston rabbi Gustavus Poznanski summed up the Southern Jewish American credo: "This Charleston synagogue is our temple, this city our Jerusalem, this happy land our Palestine, and as our fathers defended with their lives that temple, that city, and that land, so will our sons defend this temple, this city, and this land." After the Civil War, Atlanta became the region's new urban and industrial center, attracting enough of their faith to have the largest population of Jews of any city in the South. Atlanta becomes the new focal point for Jews in the South from Charleston. After the Civil War, Jewish upward mobility was described by Albert Lindemann, again he wrote Esau's Tears, which covers some of the same area as MacDonald's Culture of Critique, as, quote, "more striking in Atlanta," Jewish upward mobility from Lindemann, "than in most northern cities." And Jews routinely held positions of public trust in this ultra-Christian, militantly white supremacist region. At least 12 Jews held office in Jim Crow Atlanta between 1874 and 1911, considerable representation for a group that never exceeded 3% of the total population. Boy, you talk about history you won't learn in school, huh? In 1875, Aaron Haas became Atlanta's first mayor pro tem, and his nephews, Herbert and Leonard, would become Leo Frank's lawyers in 1913. He had a lot of lawyers. Joseph Hirsch, a millionaire clothing merchant, cotton goods manufacturer, and city council member, and other prominent Jews led in the establishment of Atlanta's racially segregated Grady Hospital, and that's still a big hospital. I remember interviewing people, and I used to write about healthcare when I was a trade journalist. Grady is a very big known name in Atlanta, their hospital. Scholar of Southern Jewry Mark K. Bauman maintains that of all the immigrant groups, the German Jewish community particularly, quote, "exerted power beyond its size so that it wielded considerable political influence and preferment. Jews played a disproportionate role in the city's economy, a high proportion being merchants, wholesalers, and tradesmen. According to one scholar, quote, "Jewish business leaders owned many of the largest commercial and manufacturing enterprises that provided employment for many local citizens." Jews were partners in their own and Gentile law firms. They sat on grand juries. They served as bank founders, presidents, and officers, and they became officials in the Chamber of Commerce. From 25 to over 35%, that's a direct quote, of Freemasons, and many of the highest officers in the Masonic order were Jews. So Jews are like a third or 30% or at least a quarter to 35% of the Masons, of the officers in the Masons down there. Praise of Jews by their Gentile neighbors was effusive, as in this 1890 statement from an Alabama merchant extolling the, quote, "Hebrews of Atlanta" in the pages of the Atlanta Constitution, quote, "There is no one element in this city's makeup more powerful than that. Look around you in any and every business, in every walk of life, and you will see that the leaders are the Hebrews. Everybody must admire the wonderful business capacity with which the race seems imbued, and everybody who makes any study of their home life will agree with me when I say that no people in the world are happier in their homes, none are better to their kinfolk, and none are better to the poor and needy. No religion has such well-organized, such sensible, and such beautiful charities. In that same year, a Jewish man, surveying his own people's accomplishments, crowed, quote, "Here in Atlanta, they, the Hebrews, are found in all walks of life, and they own, I suppose, between $2,500,000 and $3 million worth of property. That is a conservative estimate." That's from 1890. The editor of the Atlanta-based Jewish South was bursting with justifiable optimism about the fortunes of Southern Jews when he wrote in 1878, quote, "Although Judaism's," again, 1878, "although Judaism's growth in all sections of this land of the free has been most prosperous, still the South succeeded in producing the loftiest of fruits of the greatest bounty and grandeur." The Jews in Georgia, however, did more than merely become a part of the existing Georgia tradition. In many instances, they created, shaped, and influenced both the character and course of many of those traditions and institutions. So they ain't just along for the ride. They ain't just at the top. They are shaping the whole thing. When the home of National Pencil Company shareholder Oscar Pappenheimer burned out in May of 1914, 1 year since Mary Fagan's murder in his factory, the Atlanta police formed a cordon around the house to guard it overnight. It seems that Pappenheimer's jewelry collection was one of the most valuable in the city. Destroyed were, quote, "the finest pipe organ in a private home in Atlanta, 3 Steinway pianos, and prized violins and cellos." So Jews are doing just fine in the Old South, and this Reconstruction South, the Jim Crow South as well. And they're liked by the white Southerners. Jewish racism in Georgia. Jews reveled in their position as leaders among the many ethnic Europeans that settled in the American South. No public position was denied to them, and the positions they attained found them eagerly swearing a solemn oath to uphold the sacred tenets of the Jim Crow legal system, a system indistinguishable in its function and cruelty from that which is said to have victimized the Jews in Nazi Germany. Again, we're reading a book written from the black perspective, from the Nation of Islam. In fact, from the very beginning of their presence in the state, Georgia's Jews were completely untroubled by the extermination of the indigenous landowners, Creek Indians and such, or by the region's total reliance on black African slavery and all of its accompanying evils. They participated in the violence and the terror that framed the slave system and stood elbow to elbow with all whites as slavery's most ardent enforcers. Jews embraced the race laws of America voluntarily and encouraged their Gentile neighbors to adhere to them unquestionably. It would take the 13th Amendment, passed in 1865, to end American slavery legally, but a full 30 years later, in 1896, the editors of the Jewish South newspaper opined, "Negroes are intellectually, morally, and physically an inferior race, a fact none can deny." One, quote, "cultured Southern Jew saw the freed black man and woman as such," as, let me read that again. One cultured Southern Jew, that's a direct quote, "saw the freed black man and woman as such a distinct curse on his own citizenship that he wrote, quote, 'The extermination of this race is a necessary consequence of this state of affairs,'" unquote. Those words of genocide against blacks were not uttered in the hushed tones of a secret society meeting or in a remote cornfield under a burning cross, but published in a respected Jewish newspaper. Charles Rubin, a Polish immigrant growing up in Georgia, recalled, quote, "I heard the term nigger used by Jewish sons of immigrant parents with the same venom and contempt as the term jid, Russian word for yid, was used in the old country against Jews." The Ku Klux Klan emerged after the Civil War to violently force blacks back onto the plantation to perform the requisite manual labor so essential to white survival. Jews who held critical positions in the region's economy were well aware of its black foundation. so it is no surprise that Jews were actual members of that terrorist group and provisioned it with material support. The respected Atlanta resident Harry Sonnenhoff wrote with incredible irony, quote, "A lingering tradition of religious tolerance made it possible for Jews and Catholics to be members of the night riding group." Isaac Herman of Sandersville, Georgia, was a Confederate veteran and a full-fledged Ku Klux Klansman. He firmly believed the ex-slaves' quote, "best protectors were the old masters who had so lovingly provided for them." Unquote. Judah P. Benjamin, considered the most important Jew in the history of the South, was not just the enslaver of at least 140 Africans. He was so important to the South's mission to maintain slavery, his face was imprinted on the Confederate money. And there's a graphic of the $2 bill with Judah P. Benjamin on it, the number one Jew in the Old South. After the Civil War, he fled to England, did Benjamin, wherefrom he actually financed, with money from the sale of slave-picked cotton, the creation of the original Ku Klux Klan. So Judah P. Benjamin actually financed the creation of the Ku Klux Klan. There were many Jews who believed, as did Frank J. Cohen, editor of the Atlanta Weekly, The Jewish Sentiment, when he said, in perfect harmony with Klan doctrine, quote, "The white man will rule by means fair or foul. God Almighty never created the Negro the white man's equal, and even an act of Congress will not change the trend of nature or swerve the white man from his determination to retain his supremacy." In 1898, Cohen openly voiced his opinion of the gory American lynching tradition. Quote, "The white man is not only superior to the black man, but will assert his supremacy at the proper time and in the proper manner." 2 weeks later, he wrote, "North Carolina has recently done herself proud while several other states have had dignified hanging bees, lynching parties, provided by the usual cause. Those Negroes who conduct themselves properly are respected and protected, but the lawless brood who violates the sanctity of the white man's home deserves death and usually receives it with electrical swiftness." That's kind of a cool phrase. I like that, electrical swiftness. And again, on August 11, 1899, "The primary needs of the Negro race is, sick, obedience to the law and recognition of the rights of others. If the unmentionable crime against womanhood is persisted in mobs in the future will deal with him as they have in the past." That's raping white women or going after them sexually. Writer Bernard Postal, P-O-S-T-A-L, reveals yet more layers of Jewish complicity in black suffering at the hands of the most notorious organization of American terrorists of all time. Quote, "The attorneys for the Dragons, Kliegels, and other officials have not infrequently been Jews. Similarly, it has been shown that the manufacturers of the ubiquitous Klan nightgown have frequently been Jews. The present Klan has on several occasions insisted that it is not an anti-Semitic organization, a statement partially borne out by the fact that there are unquestionably Jewish members of the Klan in many states." Many writers have claimed that the Leo Frank trial rejuvenated the Ku Klux Klan, but not only is that claim untrue, such a feat would have been unnecessary. The very day Mary Fagan was murdered, April 26, 1913, was a holiday as revered in the South as Christmas in the North. So Confederate Memorial Day was equal to Christmas in the North. Confederate Memorial Day, that is April 26, the day Mary Fagan died or was murdered, closed Atlanta to honor those sons of the South. So it's Confederate Memorial Day, Saturday. She goes in to get her pay stub. The factory is closed, essentially, and there's a big parade for the Confederate Memorial Day. Confederate Memorial Day closed Atlanta to honor those sons of the South who had actually attacked America and started a war that killed 850,000 Americans, all to maintain and expand African slavery. Leo Frank himself claimed to have been writing a letter to his uncle at the very time of the murder, a letter in which he reverentially references the, quote, "thin gray line" of Confederate veterans parading outside his factory. Thin gray line in quotes. Frank's prominent Jewish backers found no inconsistency in trying to solicit the notable attorney Thomas E. Watson to defend Frank, though Watson was at the time the outspoken ideological leader of the white supremacy movement in the state of Georgia. A decade after the lynching of Leo Frank, the KKK had an office next door to the headquarters of the Federation of Jewish Charities. In 1925, Atlanta Jews held a fundraiser, and Governor Clifford Walker and Mayor Walter Sims, both well-known Klansmen, attended the affair as guests of honor. Ironically, Anti-Defamation League National Board member Dale Schwartz, the attorney who relentlessly pursued a pardon for Leo Frank in the 1980s, grew up in a merchant family in Georgia that knowingly sold disguises to Ku Klux Klan members. He said that, quote, wherever we sold a lot of white sheets, we knew that there were going to be a Klan meeting. As elsewhere in the South, Atlanta Jews applied their extraordinary political and economic power in support of the racial status quo. White gangs met and organized at the O.H. Silverman Company, building before their reign of murderous terror in the Atlanta Massacre of 1906, when they killed a bunch of blacks in a riot. Pawnbrokers Morris and Samuel Greenblatt at 123 Peters Street supplied the racist Atlanta sheriff John Nelms with guns after he spread the false provocation that, quote, the outrages upon white women must stop if every Negro in many miles of Atlanta have to be killed. Unquote. Of the dozens of blacks murdered, it is unknown how many were deaths involving guns supplied by the Greenblatt brothers. That same year, a Jewish member of the Carnegie Library Board voted to deny black Atlantans access to the public library. Foreshadowing the anti-Jewish humiliation policies of the Nazi era, Atlanta industrialist Oscar Pappenheimer, quote, wishing to distinguish between industrious and vagrant Negroes, suggested that all blacks be compelled to carry documents which would indicate their appearance, employment, abode, and prior conduct. Pappenheimer was a major stockholder in the National Pencil Company and one of the company officials who received Frank's weekly financial statements that he was working on that Saturday and talked about at length in the court. Unfortunately, the acts of Jewish racism cited above, quote, were not isolated incidents, unquote, and betray instead a consistent and well-established Jewish pattern. Despite existing at opposite poles of Georgian society, blacks and Jews were often found in intimate but dysfunctional association. The recent Eastern European immigrant Jews nursed themselves into a major force as peddlers and retail merchants, selling overpriced inferior goods in the post-slavery black shanty towns. Moreover, the Jewish merchants traded in all things with African Americans, including such socially destructive commodities as beer, wine, and liquor. And in doing so, as one scholar writes, the merchants were not so much providing the lifeblood of the black community as injecting it with poison. So they're selling vice to niggers, essentially. Black servants in Jewish homes and businesses lived in, quote, Negro tenements and one-room shacks, quote, clustered in alleys behind Jewish homes. Blacks provided a cheap, immobile, and optionless labor pool for the people of the book, quote, unquote. But they also served to deflect local prejudices, which might otherwise have been directed against Jews. Even with this critical black sacrifice in behalf of Jewish progress, there is no record of a single Jew using his office or influence to fight for a colorblind legal system, before, during, or after slavery, right up to and long past the time when Leo Frank was charged with the murder of Mary Fagan. According to Stephen Hertzberg, there is little evidence to suggest, this is a quote, that any of Atlanta's Jews desired a greater amelioration in the condition of blacks. Rather, they, quote, clearly benefited from the system of white supremacy. Georgia laws specifically targeted blacks, not Jews, and were designed to keep blacks separate, defenseless, and exploitable. Blacks could not be buried in the same cemetery as whites, nor could they eat in the same room, ride in the same automobile or railroad car, or commingle with them in any way. Barbershops were racially separate, though black barbers could tend to white male patrons. Whites and blacks could not even serve time in the same chain gang. The 1914, quote, Wood Amendment, unquote, to the segregation law gave a white citizen the right to object to a black person moving in next door to him. 10 years after Leo Frank murdered Mary Fagan, Atlanta City Council officially set up separate residential districts, and in 1931, it became illegal for a member of one race to move into a house that had previously been occupied by another race. Jews, by the way, were incontestably white by that law. Sports teams could not play within two blocks of a playground set aside for another race, and movie theaters, pool halls, and other places of amusement had to serve one race or the other. According to law, quote, any ascertainable trace of black blood in the veins of anyone made them by law, quote, colored. All of this madness was in full-fledged operation with the full participation of Jewish Georgians, even as Adolf Hitler was said to be fashioning the exact same set of laws against Jews an ocean away. Georgia's racial codes drew not a trace of Jewish indignation or protest. Perhaps the most poignant testimony came from the chosen leader of the Jews in Georgia, who told a journalist that the African American, quote, had no value in the South, unquote. That's from Melnick in Black Jewish Relations. That harshly racist assessment came from none other than the elected president of the Atlanta chapter of the B'nai B'rith, Leo Max Frank. The African American has no value in the South. So Jews clearly entered the Leo Frank drama in 1913 as privileged leaders of Atlanta's white society. Anti-Semitism was unheard of and nowhere experienced, and went unexpressed, if anywhere believed. Jews were highly regarded by the Gentile elite as useful, industrious, and even indispensable to the city's fortunes. The Gentiles embraced and assimilated with their Jewish brethren without hesitation, and both Gentile and Jew carried these religio-racial dynamics into the most explosive case in Georgia history. And that concludes on 199. Next subsection, was James Connolly coached? Two epigraphs. It is hard to conceive that any man's power of fabrication of minute details could reach that which Connolly showed, unless it be the truth. And that was said by Governor John Slayton, who the Jews somehow got to commute Frank's sentence, or at least reduce it to, not to hanging, but to life in prison. And Leo Frank, the best nigger I have ever seen. Again, section, was James Connolly, Jim Connolly, the sweeper that Frank tried to frame after his attempted frame of night watchman who discovered the body near Lee, failed. For 100 years, believers in the innocence of Leo Frank have grappled with his resounding judicial defeat by claiming that the trial testimony of James Connolly was a story entirely fabricated and fed to him by police and prosecutors. In this configuration, Connolly is the puppet with an incredible knack for delivering a prepackaged storyline. The alternative charge is that Connolly himself made up the entire tale and masterfully deceived the entire American justice system right on up to the United States Supreme Court. Steve Oney fluctuates between the two. Quote, Connolly was either the most infamous and creative liar who has ever walked the face of this city, or he was set up. It's one or the other, and I choose to believe that he was a great, great liar. Thus, Oney appears to be making two competing claims, that the white men who prosecuted Frank were engaged in an anti-Semitic persecution, but that, contrarily, they were all important victims of a Negro Svengali, someone who manipulates others and fools them. He does not feel obligated to prove either or to try to reconcile the conflicting claims. The traveling stage play about the case, Parade, by Alfred Urey, the guy who also wrote Driving with Miss Daisy and is actually from Atlanta, I believe, chooses the former, making Connolly a co-conspirator with the politically ambitious prosecutor, Hugh Dorsey. Luther Z. Rosser, frustrated in court by Connolly's impenetrable testimony, introduced the coaching charge. Question, how many times did Mr. Dorsey see you in jail? Answer, about three times. How many times did he see you at the police station? Answer, about four times. Question, then it took Mr. Dorsey seven visits to get your story straight. Why didn't you tell it all before he had been to see you seven times? Answer, I didn't want to tell it all at first. Leo Franca told him to lie, and he followed that to an extent until he broke down. Rosser did not try to prove the point, nor did the Frank defense team press the issue in any of their trial appeals. Only in rhetorical outbursts did this charge get an airing. And it is more likely that Rosser's claim was the result of his having been professionally bested in open court by two quote-unquote niggers, and thus needing a worthy white adversary to take the blame for his own defeat. After the trial, Reuben Arnold added to the alleged plot the female witnesses who exposed Frank's lascivious character, but in a newspaper interview, not in any official proceeding, colon, direct quote. These witnesses were all hostile to Frank. They were coached, rehearsed, prepared to tell their little tales, and had we cross-examined them, there is no telling on God's earth what they would have been ready to tell. The Lord only knows what fabrications they would have put before the court. The prosecution had a regular school for training and rehearsing its witnesses, and whoever was the most perfect, remembered his or her story the best, was put at the head of the class. Therefore, we would have made a very, very disastrous mistake in cross-examining any of them. The state, in obtaining its witnesses, gave a bid to the discharged employee, the men or women who hated wealth and was willing to defeat it in the spirit of the anarchist and was basely ignorant, and the basely ignorant persons who were prejudiced against the Jew. We were trapped. We were between a conspiracy hatched up by Dorsey and his colleagues, the detectives, and a jury untrained in weighing the evidence and too frightened to do so had they been properly trained. Which is completely just a great mound of bullshit from Reuben Arnold. But the only evidence that has ever been offered to support the serious felony of coaching witnesses to perjure themselves is the fact that Dorsey several times interviewed Connolly, a routine procedure in criminal cases. Frank himself attaches nefarious aims to those meetings. Quote, from Leo Frank, Connolly was continuously under the tutelage of the detectives and the solicitor, Dorsey, having seen the latter seven times. It is passing strange that in the working up of a case, a witness upon whose testimony so much depended should be so tenderly nurtured and so often visited by the prosecuting attorney. Again, this all must be consigned to defense posturing, for no details were ever supplied and no complaint was ever filed, nor were charges ever levied. Arnold's alleged, quote, regular school for training and rehearsing its witnesses, unquote, was never mentioned again. Leo Frank, however, thought there was no inconsistency in the fact that several of his own attorneys and hired detectives visited him daily while he was incarcerated in an area of the jail cordoned off just for that purpose. They planned out his defense strategy and carefully rehearsed with him his own unsworn trial statement. So they're accusing others of what they actually did themselves. The alleged coaching to give perjured testimony as opposed to coaching in presentation skills, i.e. diction, what words use, manner, control of emotions, etc., would have to have been quite an involved process, given that Connolly's testimony was nearly 16 hours, the longest in the state's history. Yet the alleged coaching scheme utterly collapses under the weight of its own absurdity. That white men of prominence and standing in Jim Crow, Georgia, would conspire to embrace and protect, quote, a low type of Negro, unquote, guilty of the rape and murder of a white child, in order to pin said crime on a prominent white man, is the scenario that Frank's supporters demand the public to believe. The co-claim that Connolly could bamboozle the entire court system, the press, and the public in the state with the highest lynching rate in the Union is equally absurd and self-evidently preposterous. The observation by University of California historian Albert Lindemann is telling. Quote, Even today, one must wonder how Dorsey himself could have embarked upon such a risky enterprise as coaching Conley in a fabricated testimony, knowing him to be guilty and surely knowing what experts in cross-examination could do to a witness who had concocted an elaborate false testimony. It seems, moreover, unbelievable that Dorsey and the other lawyers for the prosecution, Frank Hooper and Edward A. Stevens, could have been so reckless as to thus risk a humiliating collapse of their case against Frank. And what might have happened to their reputations and future careers if Conley, having broken down in full courtroom, had testified that Dorsey coached him in false testimony? Yeah, it's completely absurd. It's just a lie made up by Jews after the fact. Conley recounted instances and events that had no bearing on the case, all of which could be traced for verification. His recollection of walking Atlanta streets together with Frank through an open market with many customers, for instance, placed Frank out in the market with a man Frank says he never saw on the day of the murder. No prosecutor concocting a tale for a witness would have allowed so many chances for a refutation. In addition to that, some of the most damaging parts of Conley's testimony were about Frank's history of sexual activities at the factory, not about his actions on the day of the murder. His revelations helped build the prosecutor's charge that Frank had developed a system and a pattern of sexual encounters with young girls in which he intended to entrap Mary Fagan. So the alleged coaching would have had to include a range of time and events spanning months, rather than just those activities occurring on the day of the murder. Further, it is clear both the prosecutor and the defense knew what Conley could say on the matter of Frank's sexual affairs, but there was but a minuscule chance that the subject would come up at trial. By Georgia trial rules, it would be entirely up to Frank's defense lawyers to raise the specter of their client's character, and Dorsey never would have expected that Frank's highly experienced attorneys would so easily subject their client to that swamp of unseemly evidence. In their pretrial analysis, even the amateur trial speculators at the Atlanta Constitution discussed the remoteness of that possibility, stating that there is, quote, not one chance in 100 that Frank's team would allow this line of attack. To everyone's astonishment, Frank's legal eagles flew right into that swamp, and when they did, Conley was just one of many who convincingly testified to the sleazy side of Frank's personality, none of the testimonies conflicting with the known facts or with each other. So the coaching of Conley to convincingly recite testimony that had the most improbable chance of being heard would have been an extraordinarily time-consuming and fruitless effort and a professionally perilous gamble. The coaching of a witness to commit perjury in a trial setting presents its own set of difficulties, but the coaching of a witness to physically reenact a fabricated set of behaviors poses an altogether different set of challenges. On May 30th, James Conley was taken from jail to the scene of the crime, where he walked officials and reporters through the National Pencil Company demonstrating his involvement in helping Frank conceal Mary's body. According to those reporters who witnessed the scene, Conley did not appear to be concocting anything. Quote, "The Negro's pantomime was thorough in detail. He overlooked no part depicted in his astounding confession of the night before. He often even lay down upon the floor so as to minutely picture the position of the victim's body at certain stages of its removal into the cellar. With wavering voice that frequently choked slightly as though from some tragic recollection of the grim occurrence, he verbally explained his actions on the murder day." Another consideration that factors against the coaching claim is that Conley is but one of many whose corroborating evidence had to synchronize with his storyline. Indeed, Hugh Dorsey would have had to stage manage an elaborate choreography of, quote, anti-Semitic lies and evidentiary fabrication, starting with two of the most prominent and staunchly independent detective firms in America, the Pinkerton and the William J. Burns agencies. Neither was based in Georgia, and it is highly unlikely that either would risk its national reputation to join in with the anti-Semitic scheming of some politically ambitious local prosecutor. Moreover, both these nationally known competitors, whilst they were both on Frank's payroll, independently concluded that Frank did indeed murder Mary Fagan. At least 14 white witnesses corroborated Conley's story. someone would have had to, quote, coach them all and keep them quiet in this grand conspiracy. Those falsified, perjured testimonies would have had to be scripted and coordinated to be even remotely convincing to an all-white male jury, to a white judge who had exhibited a clear pro-Frank bias throughout the trial, and to a white press that was competing daily to bring out every nuance of the trial. And all those cooperating white witnesses, none of whom were under any legal burden, would have had to agree to be part of an illegal scheme to lie under oath, not only to protect a lower-class Negro murderer, but to knowingly place a noose around the neck of their innocent employer, a prominent white man. As we will see, Frank unleashed a veritable army of strong-arm agents and dumped piles of cash on the so-called factory girls, inducing some of them to recant their damaging testimony. But in their recantations, often temporary, none of them described a, quote, regular school, unquote, for coaching witnesses. Ultimately, despite the defense pressure, all of those witnesses recanted their recantations, some even adding more lurid details about their dealings with Leo Frank. A measured assessment of the coaching change inevitably finds the very idea of collapsing of its own absurdity. Detective William J. Burns was rehired by Frank for his post-conviction extrajudicial operations, and he ultimately admitted that the talk about Dorsey being prejudiced, meaning anti-Semitic, was bosh. Quote, "The solicitor has done no more than to prosecute an important case in a very vigorous and capable manner." Unquote. Coaching charges persist. We're on 205 now. We have about five more pages to go. So they're very clearly refuting. Jews just came up with a lot of crap after the fact to try to mislead people, and they've consistently lied about it, or inconsistently lied about it too. When they find something better, they switch from one story to another. And that is their way in all things. But the fact is, Leo Frank was guilty. There's no real doubt about it. Claims of witness coaching and the rest are absolutely absurd from every logical point of view, let alone that there's no facts presented to back that claim. Coaching charges persist. The latest incarnation of this coaching claim appears in the 2009 PBS documentary series, Frontline, which aired a 90-minute docudrama by writer, producer, and docudrama in quotes, by Ben Loderman, titled The People v. Leo Frank, L-O-E-T-E-R-M-A-N, The People versus Leo Frank, with Steve Oney listed as a chief consultant and the ADL of B'nai B'rith sponsoring many screenings of the film. The production must be taken as the, quote, official, unquote, account of the case by the believers in Frank's innocence. The film departs from many well-worn tropes, but it adds others. After nearly a century of recriminations, the production clears Dorsey entirely of the, quote, coaching, unquote, charge. Instead, Loderman, following the thesis of Oney's book, advances the notion that Conley's attorney, William Smith, quote, coached his client in the testimony at the trial. Smith entered the case at the end of May once James Conley opened up to police about Leo Frank's role in Mary Fagan's murder. The Atlanta Georgian hired Smith to be the lawyer for the destitute and friendless factory sweeper as he sat in the Fulton County Jail. So, wow, the paper hired William Smith to defend this lowly black James Conley when he was in jail. The Georgian's editors were not interested in Conley's civil rights. Instead, in the cutthroat competitive climate of Atlanta's three daily newspapers, again, we're before the electronic age for the most part, they were angling for insight information about the case and the state star witness. I mean, there's no TV and radio. Maybe it was just starting to get going. So the newspapers are the game. So they hire him, not because they give a crap about him, but because they wanted kind of a inside corner on the coverage. In his Frontline tale, Loderman conceals Smith's Georgian connection, his newspaper connection, but shows him tutoring Conley on how to tell a bulletproof tale in court. Loderman's is the first and strongest statement ever made on the alleged coaching process. But Smith also eludes condemnation by Frank partisans because after successfully coaching the testimony of Conley, it is said that Smith went through a soul-searching process that resulted in his shifting his allegiance from his own client to Leo Frank. Loderman's tale nevertheless has fatal weaknesses that buckle under the most elementary analysis. It is true that after the trial and conviction of Frank, Smith turned against his black client and claimed to believe in his guilt. But in his highly publicized pirouette, he provided no proof of that claim, and there is evidence that suggests that Smith may have succumbed to defense pressure, not to a guilty conscience. And here is where Oney and Loderman's thesis loses its steam. If Smith were the primary coach of James Conley, Smith could have detailed his role in preparing Conley for perjury. But in the 36 years he lived after the trial, he died in 1949, Smith never revealed or intimated any such nefarious consultations with Conley, sessions that Oney refers to as, quote, midnight seances, unquote. Smith did not reveal his interactions with Dorsey or the police or other witnesses, all of whom would be needed to properly coordinate any perjury. Nor did he charge that anti-Semitism played a role in his own or anyone else's actions. Had he done so, it would have provided evidence enough to free Leo Frank and hang James Conley. It would have broken the back of the prosecution's case and exposed the supporting witnesses as utter frauds. Smith's oddly worded statement to the press really didn't amount to much at all. Quote, I am sure that investigation by the proper authorities will prove conclusively that the black is the man who is the slayer. Steve Oney is the source for this threadbare coaching by Smith theory, but surprisingly, he devotes but a single paragraph of his 742-page book to this alleged coaching, in which he writes that, quote, over many long evenings, unquote, Smith trained Conley in the presentation arts. Quote, the lawyer edified his pupil on the rules of discourse, stressing the importance of enunciation, timing, and maintaining eye contact with an audience. Then Smith, a fair mimic, gave the Negro a taste of Luther Rosser's corrosive manner, preparing him for the inevitable courtroom encounter. Oney's description makes no mention of perjury and points only to that advice all trial lawyers offer their clients. You know, maintain eye contact, be direct, speak clearly, and enunciate so that everyone can understand you and you look plausible. He nonetheless provides but two sources for his quote-unquote coaching claim. One, his own interview in 1986 with William Smith's youngest son, Walter, who was not yet born at the time of the Leo Frank affair and thus has no firsthand knowledge of the alleged process. And two, Leo Frank's own writings, though he was in jail at the time and thus could only offer self-interested speculation. None of Oney's account is attested to by William Smith himself, nor by jail officials or newspaper reporters, nor by Frank's extensive staff of attorneys and private investigators. So it's just a Jew pulling shit out of his ass and flinging it out for the public. The Oney-Loderman theory leaves more questions than answers, thus compromising itself in the process. In the end, the charge of coached testimony, coached is always in quotes in this section, subordination of perjury or witness tampering has no reliable foundation, and leaves Leo Frank exactly as the jury sentenced him, duly convicted of the murder of Mary Fagan. Next subsection. Quote, I disremember, unquote, I disremember the Jewish mockery of a black man. Luther Z. Rosser's disastrous cross-examination of James Conley only gave prosecutor Hugh Dorsey more rope to hang Leo Frank. One part of that confrontation requires a closer look. As Rosser's game plan collapsed in open court, he resorted to an interrogation tactic that was designed to elicit from Conley the repeated response, I don't know. In the abstract, the repetitive answer, I don't know, makes Conley appear to be evasive or to have a selective memory or even to be coached. Frank's supporters argue that it is suspicious that Conley's mind seemed so clear in testimony against Frank, but murky and even vacant when Rosser posed questions to him in Frank's defense. Harry Golden spoke for them. Quote, That Frank had a poor memory was patent. It seemed he could only remember the crime and Frank's perversion. As he continued, Rosser made Conley admit he was a liar. The key to understanding this testimony, however, is not in the memory of James Conley, but in the substance of Rosser's questions. His questions were designed to demand such detail that few could reasonably be expected to answer them with any accuracy. To wit, Rosser asked for details about the several times Conley acted as a lookout while Frank had sexual trysts at the factory. Quote, "How was she dressed that night?" one of the women. Conley's answer, "I disremember." Referring to another time, Rosser demanded, "Give me a description of those young ladies." Quote, "I disremember what the ladies did have on." "What did you do the Saturday before you watched for him the first time?" "I disremember." "What did you do the Saturday after you watched for him the first time?" "I disremember." Rosser asked Conley for exact days when he was paid on the weeks that he watched for Frank. He asked Conley whether he had seen another factory employee on a specific day of the 5 days he had watched for Frank, and he asked who worked at the factory on Conley's days off. He asked Conley for the color of a man's eyelashes. He asked Conley what wages were of other employees and what habits and schedule they had in getting paid. He asked Conley to describe a man's clothes the second time he saw him. To all these types of questions, Conley answered, "I disremember," or "I don't know," or "I don't remember." What's more, Rosser was interrogating Conley about incidences that had occurred over a period of a year ending in 1912. But on the crucial and relevant details of the April 26, 1913 murder, which had occurred just 3 months before the trial, Conley was clear and lucid, his testimony incontrovertible. So Conley's allegedly selective memory must be viewed in the context of the leading questions he was being asked. Leo Frank's performance as a witness, however, has never been considered for its veracity and degree of forgetfulness. Conley's testimony was given about 100 days from the April 26th murder. Frank's only actual sworn testimony in an official hearing came just 10 days after the murder during the coroner's inquest on May 5th, 1913. There, Frank underwent approximately 4 hours of questioning about his activities on the day of the murder. The Atlanta Constitution's account of Frank's absent-mindedness covers only a small portion of his 4 hours on the stand, wherein he evasively answered, "I don't know," to many easy questions. "Can you name the guests at the party at your house on April 26th? Frank's answer, I don't remember them all." There were seven, and his own mother-in-law said that Frank spoke with them for 20 minutes. "What topic was discussed at home?" Frank's reply, I don't remember. Indeed, all of the family claimed to, quote, disremember any topic of conversation at that dinner party. How plausible is that? Completely implausible. They don't want to admit what they were talking about. More of Leo Frank's responses taken from the Constitution articles are counted in a catalog verbatim. "I don't remember," 10 times. "I don't recollect," 2 times. "I did not notice," 2 times. "I don't know," 2 times. "Not that I remember," 1 time. "I don't recollect that I did," 1 time. All right, last page of this session. And more. "I can't recollect," 1 time. "No, I forgot," 1 time. "No, I don't," 11 times. "And I don't remember," precisely 1 time. So over and over again. "I don't remember," "I don't know," "I don't recall," "I don't recollect," "I disremember," blah, blah, on and on and on and on. The Atlanta Journal recorded similarly Frank's answers to the coroner's questions about his movements on the day of the murder. "I didn't notice," 3 times. "I don't remember," 3 times. "I don't recollect," 1 time. "I don't know," 1 time. "I wasn't asked," 1 time. At the same hearing, Leo Frank's father-in-law, Emil Selig, was asked about Frank's reaction on Sunday to the homicide at his factory the day before. Quote, "He seemed unconcerned," and, quote, "I didn't remember," unquote, Frank mentioning the murder the rest of the day. His mother-in-law, Mrs. Selig, coldly testified that Frank, quote, mentioned it casually and that she, quote, didn't attach much importance to it. The Atlanta Georgian reporter heard Frank answer, quote, "I don't remember," so often that a section heading of the article was titled, quote, "Often does not remember," unquote. More examples. I don't remember 8 times. I did not notice once. I don't remember them all once. I don't remember saying anything to her once. I don't recollect once. I don't recollect that I did once. It should not escape the notice of students of the case that this I don't know refrain of a seemingly forgetful and unobservant engineer is exactly what landed the factory superintendent on trial for murder. To Mary Fagan's last known question, has the metal arrived yet? Leo Frank gave the fateful response, I don't know. Before leading her, the prosecution successfully argued, to her doom. Lying little Jew bastard. And that's how we'll close today's session. We made it up through page 210, through the trial, and now through the various bullshit the Jews concocted after the trial to misrepresent what happened. They never give up, even when they're convicted and found guilty, even when they're lynched. They never give up lying to defend their own, the lowest sort of scum humanly imaginable. That's Jews. Truly an evil group of liars. Thanks for being with me today. My name again is Alex Linder. I'm at VNNforum.com, where you can find these recordings archived, also at alexlinder.com. I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll do more from the Leo Frank case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man, a book published by researchers from the Nation of Islam.